Blog Talk Radio. You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for being with us. Tonight, we'll be looking at 47 years later, the Great March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom in 1963. The murder of a 14-year-old boy in Money, Mississippi, Emmett Till. And we will recall, 5 years later, Katrina, still hovering over the city of New Orleans, Louisiana. I'm Janice Grant, and I'll be listening for you.
Proclamation that freed the slaves, 200,000 people converge on the nation's capital to rally for civil rights. They come by train, they come by bus and by air. They come from the north, the south, the east and west. They come united in one cause, to urge Congress to pass a civil rights bill to end forever the blight of racial inequity. This great throng with a cause gathers on the mall that stretches from the Washington Monument toward the Capitol. From the break of dawn, they filter into the city. It is estimated that 40,000 had assembled. But it's more like a Sunday outing as they form into groups and discuss the day quietly. They are scheduled to move to the Lincoln Memorial at noon to hear the top leaders of the movement. Those leaders, at the moment, are conferring on Capitol Hill with members of Congress, pointing up the aims of the rally. By 11:30, there are more than 200,000 thronging the mall, a crowd that is bigger than the most optimistic forecasts. Now there's a growing animation. It seems as if the demonstrators were finding strength in each other and discovered their cause was a bond. The crowd became impatient to get started, and they moved toward the Lincoln Memorial before the scheduled hour. They move with good humor, laughter, and song. Few realize that in a sense they are participants in an historical day. It will become part of the American scene that today's gathering is the largest in Washington's history. The men who organized the rally walk with springing steps toward the speaker stand. On the left, Roy Wilkins with A. Philip Randolph. They have fought their fight all of their adult lives. In the van is Martin Luther King, who has been jailed 12 times on racial issues. Others on hand include Walter Reuther, head of the auto workers. Authorities were fearful of disorders, and there were 5,000 uniformed men on duty. They had little to do but keep dissident groups away from the rally. Arrests in Washington were below normal. Police attribute this to the fact that for the first time in 30 years, you couldn't even buy a beer in Washington. The civil rights marchers needed no stimulants like that. They provided their own with songs that ranged from the sacred to the hillbilly, but with the one recurring theme, the cause of 20 million Negroes.
We shall overcome.
reflecting pool before the Lincoln Memorial occupies every inch on the lawns and under the trees. And there's a great swell of cheers to welcome Martin Luther King to the speaker's podium, a man who stands as a symbol of all they are fighting for. King and the other leaders are to go to the White House, where the president said that everyone must be impressed with the demonstration of the throng's faith and confidence in our democratic form of government. However, he warned, there's a long fight ahead in Congress. The theme, the keynote, the thought uppermost in minds of all here today is best set forth by Dr. King. He sums up a day the Capitol will long remember.
I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yes. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will they be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood? I have a dream.
Washington, D.C., 1963. Democracy.
And thank you for being with us here tonight. At our common ground, I'm Janice Graham, your host, and we do so much welcome our listening audience as well as those in the chat room. We are pleased to see the queen of daytime talk at Blog Talk Radio, Miss India DeClara. Thank you for being with us. And tonight, here at our common ground, we're so happy to have as our co-host once again on this Our Common Ground Saturday night open mic, Alpho of the Alpho Show, heard here on Saturdays at 3 p.m. on Blog Talk Radio, and we have Don and some guests. Tonight here at Our Common Ground, we're going to be remembering and recalling three very, very important things, events that happened in and around this country in that impacts black people profoundly. The first is the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, or as we call it, the Great March on Washington. It was largely a huge political rally in support of civil and economic rights for African Americans, and it took place in Washington, D.C. It was a Wednesday. I remember I was 13 years old, and I was there. It was the event where Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King delivered his historic I Have a Dream speech, and we'll be hearing that speech here tonight at Our Common Ground, advocating a racial harmony at the Lincoln Memorial during the march. The march was initiated by A. Philip Randolph, the president of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, the president of the Negro American Labor Council, and vice president of the AFL-CIO. Randolph had planned a similar march in 1944 as well. The threat of the earlier march had convinced President Roosevelt to establish the Committee on Fair Employment Practices and bar discrimination hiring in the defense industry. The other thing that we are looking at tonight is today, August 28th, the 50th anniversary of the murder of Emmett Till. Later on in this program, we'll be providing an audio documentary that I put together for this show to put everything in context around the murder of Emmett Till and what it meant 3 years after his murder to bring together the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. Today also, we are looking at the commemoration, the remembrance, and the recalling of a hurricane by the name of Katrina.
which hit the Gulf Coast of Louisiana, Mississippi, and parts of Alabama. And we'll be looking at where we are in New Orleans. Alpha, thank you so much for being with me tonight, my brother. How are you?
Good evening, Janice. I'm just doing just ducky.
Just ducky. You know, it's interesting, Alpha, that we are commemorating all of these things. Emmett Till's 50th anniversary of his murder, the 47th anniversary of the Great March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, and also the 5th anniversary since the destruction of New Orleans, Louisiana. And at the same date, we're also looking at another rally that they will be talking about 50 years from now, which is the Becca Fest. That's they called it the Reclaiming Honor or Doing Something About Honor, and we're going to talk a little bit about that in the context of the March on Washington. Before we get started, Alpha, I was 13, and my parents journeyed from South Florida with me in tow, handing out the fried chicken and the deviled eggs and the wet naps and the Coca-Colas out of the chest that occupied the back seat of our 1963 Cadillac. Where were you on the day of this march? What do you remember?
The day of that particular march, let me get this straight. I was every bit of, I must have been every bit of 10 years old, headed toward 11. But no clue. No clue.
Mm-hmm.
All I know I was living in a housing project here in Chicago.
Uh-huh.
And but, that was the furthest thing from our minds.
It's really interesting how people. Did you watch it on TV?
No. Watch it on TV. I was outside playing baseball or something. But I mean, and I'm saying this simply to say that that's how disconnected we as a people were. Our parents, my mom was not in that vein, in that ilk. She was too busy as a single mother simply trying to survive and keep it together. And if
this was
the weekend, she was off busy either shopping or trying to do laundry.
I hear you. You know, it's really interesting that we do experience all of these things very differently, because this was a monumental turn in what my adult life would be like. I cannot tell you how at age 13, how moved I was. It was, you know, we went by private car, but there was a bus that came out of my community going to the March on Washington. There were many, many buses on the Florida highway, which was not 95. There was no 95 at the time. And one of the games that I always played was being able to match up the number. There was a number. Every county had a number on a Florida license plate tag, and calling out to my parents, knowing what the number meant in terms of the county. And as we got further up into North Florida, being able to see, and then being able to call out the number of states of cars that were on the highway. But once we arrived there, even though I lived in the segregated South, the sea of people, I will never forget the sea of people. And we were not that far. We were like five or six lines behind the first line going up to the Lincoln Memorial where all of the speakers. And I remember kind of being bored. But then there was a man, a young man there, and he was speaking. And I knew who he was. He was John Lewis, who is now the congressman from Georgia. I had met him at a AME Sunday school convention where he ran a workshop while he was in college. And that got my attention to paying attention to more of the speakers. I knew who these people were. I remember that we were walking and we ran into Thurgood Marshall and his family. And I mean, but it was at the moment where the crowd was so very quiet that it dawned on me that we were a powerful people as Negroes, that we had the ability. And I remember thinking to myself, I had always wanted to be a lawyer in the footsteps of my father, but I remember thinking, I can't just be a lawyer. I've got to be a lawyer like, and the only person I knew that was on the podium was Justice Marshall. I've got to be like Thurgood Marshall. I've got to make a difference. And I came away, and when I was really, really tired because we got into D.C. like on a Monday, and we had been gone to visit this person, that person, and the other person, and some other people, and I was being dragged around by my parents, and I was on the way back thinking to myself, am I going to be able to make, to do this? To do all of these wonderful things that these people were talking about that we need to do. We're going to be taking your calls at Our Common Ground at 347-838-9852. But first, we do want to pause because one of the most momentous pieces of American political rhetoric was delivered at the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom. And we want to welcome those of you who are just joining us. On this August 28th, more than 2,000 buses, 21 special trains, 10 chartered airliners, and uncounted cars converged on Washington, D.C. All regularly scheduled planes, trains, and buses were also filled to the capacity. The march began at the Washington Monument and ended up at the Lincoln Memorial with the program of music and speakers. The march failed, of course, because it was CP time, to start on time because leaders were meeting with members of the Congress, and to the leaders' surprise, I'm sure they were surprised, the assembled group began to march from the Washington Monument to the Lincoln Memorial without them. One of those people, among Floyd McKissick, the songs of Mahalia Jackson and Joan Baez and Peter, Paul, and Mary and Bob Dylan, the voices of John Lewis of SNCC, but among all of that, among media attention that gave the march national exposure, rose a young black Boston University Morehouse-educated preacher from Alabama, and his name was Dr. Martin Luther King. And this is what he had to say. And when we listen, we want to hear your experience, your response, where, what you are thinking today August 28th, 2010.
I am happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration of freedom in the history of our nation. 54 years ago, a great American in whose symbolic shadow we stand today signed the Emancipation Proclamation. This momentous decree came as the great beacon light of hope to millions of Negro slaves who had been seared in the flames of withering injustice. It came as a joyous daybreak to end the long night of their captivity. But 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languishing in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. So we've come here today to dramatize the shameful condition. In a sense, we've come to our nation's capital to cast a check. When the architects of our republic wrote the magnificent words of the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, they were signing a promissory note to which every American felt the call as. This note was a promise that all men, yes, black men as well as white men, would be guaranteed the inalienable rights of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. It is obvious today that America has defaulted on this promissory note insofar as her citizens of color are concerned. Instead of honoring this sacred obligation, America has given the Negro people a bad check, a check which has come back marked insufficient funds. But we refuse to believe that the Bank of Justice is bankrupt. We refuse there are insufficient funds in the great halls of opportunity of this nation. So we've come to cash this check, a check that will give us the funds demand, the riches of freedom, and the security of justice. This is no time to engage in the luxury of cooling off or to take the tranquilizing drug of gradualism. Now is the time to make real promises for tomorrow. Now is the time to rise from the dark and desolate valley of segregation. Now is the time. victory is not an end, but a beginning. Those who hope that the Negro needed to blow off steam and will now be content will have a rude awakening if the nation returns to business as usual. And I will see the rest of our liberty in America till the Negro is granted. That is something that I must say to my people, who stands on the warm threshold which leads into the palace of justice. In the process of gaining our rightful place, we must not be guilty of wrong deeds. Let us not seek to satisfy our thirst for freedom by drinking from the cup of bitterness and hatred. We must not allow our trained protest to degenerate into political power. Again and again, we must rise to the majestic height of meeting physical force with soul force. The marvelous new militant, which has disrupted the Negro community, must not lead us to the distrust of all whites. For many of our white brothers, as evidenced by their presence here today, have come to realize that their destiny is part of our destiny. They have come to realize that their freedom is inextricably bound to our freedom. We cannot walk alone. As we walk, we must make the pledge to lead the long way march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who ask for the devastation of civil rights. When will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is a victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro's basic mobility is from a smaller ghetto to a larger one. We can never be satisfied as long as our children are stripped of their selfhood and robbed of their dignity by signs saying for white women. We cannot be satisfied as long as the Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and the Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote.
Except for the parts that we hear so very often where Dr. King starts talking about the dream, And he says that I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. And he goes on to say that I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted, every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. This is our hope, and this is the faith that I go back to the South with. And, you know, Alpha, one of the things that I will never, ever forget, while Dr. King was speaking, my father wept. And that is an experience, and that is an image that was embedded, and I knew then that my life, that I had to affect the world in some way. Alpha, you want to go to the phones?
Sure, let's go to the phones, Janice. Before we take the call, though, I want to say that listening to you listen to the speech, and if I've heard it once, I've heard it 10 times. And listening to it over, it never gets old, because it was so profound, it was so true, it was so to the point, it touched all bases.
Exactly.
It touched every base, it touched every...
47 years ago.
Exactly.
And we want to talk, you know, we want to talk about the meaning that it had. You know, one of the things that I'm approaching this discussion is a word that sticks out for me is context.
Exactly.
That we need to look at it in the context of its time and our time.
And exactly, because you can bring that, you can say those same words and they will be in effect today.
Yes. Those,
you can touch the base, everything he speaks of.
Yes,
I mean, there,
absolutely.
We've made progress in simply the fact that the racism isn't so blatant. Now it's kind of an underlying whirlwind. It's that funnel. It's that down the drain funnel, and it's under the surface. It's like a riptide. But it's still
there. And one of the things that people like Glenn Beck don't understand, that the I Have a Dream speech had been made in black churches throughout the South for 15 to 25 years before there was a march on Washington in 1963. 111, you're on the air. Tell us who you are and what are your thoughts about this speech and this day, 47 days later.
47 years later. Hey, this is Richie,
sorry,
Connecticut. How's it going, guys?
All right.
Hey, Richie, good to hear from you.
Yeah, man. I don't want to let the Glenn Beck thing overshadow the importance of today, but...
Oh, no, we're not talking about Glenn Beck. He has nothing
I know. But, hey, man, just a thought, and let me finish before the co-host jams it down my throat. That speech is old news, and it's going to be old news, because the way I was raised, I'm 37 years old, and the way I'm raising my children, I almost don't know about the racial division that existed prior to me. And my mother reminded me, she was from Texas, she remembers segregated bathrooms. I don't remember most of it, and my children won't remember any of it. And it's kind of a good thing, and we can teach our children the history. But I think the dream, it has been realized. Let's not hold on to the bad parts of it. We can talk about history. But hopefully it is old news someday. It's just part of ancient history. And, you know, we are all equal. We are all God's children. And thank you, co-host, for not jamming that down my throat before letting me finish. But your thoughts on that?
Well, I look at it like this. You know, as you said, you're 37 years old, which means you were born after the fact, which means there are certain things that you haven't realized, that you haven't come across or experienced. So I can understand why you can visualize that as being old news, or you can be dismissive of it, because you haven't walked in those shoes.
Right,
and unless
right.
you walk in those shoes, and unless you forget or simply refuse to educate yourself with the history of this nation, you will be out of touch with what people have experienced and why people hold on to this particular day, because this was, I would have to say, the greatest speech of our time.
I would agree. I would agree. And I do not forget and I do not dismiss. But again, I think it would be a good thing if our children don't know the way that it was. And again, I didn't grow up in that era. I don't know. And I know the history, but I'm glad that I haven't realized it in my life. My children won't. And, you know, I have a 7-year-old and a 1-year-old, and in school they don't see color. And it's funny, when children aren't raised in an era of racism, they'll look at each other funny sometimes, and even my 7-year-old picking at his little black friend's hair, realizing that he's different a little bit. You just shrug your shoulders? Yeah, he's different a little bit. So is another white boy over there. And it's kind of fun to know that, you know, at least, you know, in my family, we're past that, and a lot of people are.
Well, you're right.
Well, you know, unfortunately, Richie, this country is not past that. I grew up in the Jim Crow South. I went to segregated schools. I spent 3 years at MIT being the only black student. I spent 4 years being one of 5 black students at Wellesley College. I have a 9-year-old grandson who does have to know about what this speech means. He does have to understand his differences and what it means, because he faces families that are not like yours, families that children who do hear the worst of the racist elements in this nation. So he has to be prepared, and black children, black people are not immune. Let me suggest something to you, Richie, and we're going to
sure.
go to the next call, and I really do appreciate your call. And I am so glad that there are white people who are immune to and live in a zone where race is not important. Race is not a factor. But let me refer you to one of my very good friends who I've known a very long time, Tim Wise. And he explores the issue of race and white people who are working toward anti-racism, and I think you would enjoy reading some of his work. You can find him at timwise.org. And
is that W-I-S-E, the common, is it the common spelling?
Yes.
Okay.
And I applaud you, and one of the things that I would encourage you to do is to talk to your children about race, so that they understand and they can be supportive and do anti-racism work and have anti-racism interaction with children who are victims of racism.
That makes sense. I will. Hey,
yeah.
Thank you for taking my call. I'm going to look that up, man. I'm going to listen to the program, guys.
Well, thank you. Thank
okay.
you very
thank
much
you,
for your call.
Hey, if you don't mind, put me on mute or hold so I can keep listening. I'm outside.
Watch you.
Okay. Okay, I'm going to mute you and go to 200. Thank you for your call. You're on Our Common Ground. I respect you, Hotep. You're on the air.
Hello. Hello, can you hear
Hello.
Me?
Yes, I can.
Yes, I'm sorry. My name is Craig Shaw from Ohio. I actually have Victor. Hi, how are you? I actually have Victor on the line with me, too.
Yes,
uh-huh.
Hi.
Hey,
okay.
Hi, Victor. Hi.
Thanks for being with us tonight. What's
yeah,
your response to this King speech?
Well, I your previous caller, I somewhat agree with him, but I depart on a couple of things. So I'm going to kind of change what I initially was going to say. I agree with him that I think we all can agree that we have come a long way as far as the the amount of racism in our culture, and this is his very important historical speech, but I am a firm believer that we can't be dismissive of certain periods as we grow as a nation. And So it is a very important point in history that needs to be in our history books and in all of our children. I'm 34, so I guess I want to point that out too. So I'm of the same generation as he is. So a lot of the things that he is talking about, you know, I haven't seen either. So, but we need to always keep in mind our horrific things that happened in our past, so that we can try to avoid going back down that road. And I also want to point out, though, that I think that some of the bumps and a lot of this animosity also comes from that you know, we cannot legislate race relations either. It's got to be ingrained, and we have to teach our children and teach each other about our differences, so that we can, you know, because a lot of racism comes from ignorance. I'm sure. I mean, do you guys agree with that, or?
Well, let me try to respond to some of the things that you said, Craig. One of the things is that I think that white people of goodwill really have to understand and get to an understanding of the way in which race plays in our society for people who are victims of racism. And that wouldn't be you. You have a certain kind of, there's a privilege that you have to deny and to insulate yourself from the issues of race. Black people don't have that insulation. And that is why the King speech, the context of the speech, is so relevant today. For instance, yes, you cannot I cannot regulate your prejudice or of any kind. But the legislation is very important. The public policy is very important to inoculate, to try to eliminate the present effects of past discrimination and the present is discrimination. We cannot deny there is racial discrimination in employment. There's racial discrimination in hiring. There's racial discrimination in public accommodation. I don't know if you read the report on just yesterday about a school district in Mississippi who had delegated that the black kids couldn't run for president of the class in a junior high school. Only whites could. And the black kids had to have other positions designated by the school administration. Those things are still happening. The idea that Oscar Grant was shot down in a San Francisco transportation center by a San Francisco policeman while he was handcuffed and shot in his back is a form of racial violence that happens every day in black and brown communities. And that is why the protection of legislation is so important.
Okay, can I respond to that?
Yep.
Okay, I want to make something clear that I am not attacking legislation. What I was merely trying to point out that is once you pass legislation, that is not a kumbaya moment that racism is eradicated. You still have to go first. That's what I was referring to.
Yeah, because enforcement
in respect to legislation, legislation doesn't erase the problem.
Right.
It merely provides a source of it provides the ability to carry out. I'm sorry, I'm trying to think of the word. I can't think of it,
I
but it's
you.
A it provides a tool if the individual becomes a victim.
It
they have a
redress.
Say that again. Yes,
redress.
That is the perfect word. So. That's what my statement on the legislation. Now I will like to point out one point though, and I guess this is just kind of throwing it out there. On my show, we've kind of talked about it. There are certain effects if you take certain legislation too far, in the fact that if you hold up a certain demographic of people prop them up too far, by default you are taking another
Hold
demographic
on for a minute, Craig. Let me stop you on that
okay.
point, and I'm hoping Alpha will jump in here.
Well,
when you are a victim of discrimination of any kind, when you
mm-hmm.
are a victim of racial harassment, when you are a victim of any kind, anything, it seems to me that the notion of going too far to protect me for my civil rights or human rights is kind of going too far. There is nothing more genuine, more precious to me than my civil rights, my human rights as a human being. So you can't go far enough.
And let me add.
I'm not understanding this concept of you go too far.
Let me add into that.
Are you talking
about
affirmative action?
And I understand a little what Craig is talking about. And here's
uh-huh.
I'm not here hostile. I just want you to understand that.
I understand you're not, Craig. I understand you're not.
Here.
No. It's not about hostility or anything like that. This is simply an explanation of, you know, when you speak of going too far. When they legislated and tried to legislate, and they couldn't legislate racism away. They could not legislate it away because it was already embedded into our society to the highest levels of law enforcement, the people who sit on the bench, then the whole nine yards. So when people seek redress and the protection of their civil rights, and they come face to face with someone of that ilk who won't protect their civil rights because of the racism that they have been taught. See, children are taught racism. You can put children together, and if they haven't been taught racism, there will be no racism. It's only once they get away from that mixture, once they get, you know, back to with their parents and with the whole, you know, with that isolation. Racism is taught. No one is born with it. And I use this, and I only use this as an analogy. Picture the hanging of the lynching of a black man. And in that lynching, in that picture of that lynching, under that tree, you see white people gathered. But you see white people in their 60s, 40s, 30s, 20s, teens. And that is generational. Racism is taught, and it's generational. The previous caller, Richie, you know, he says he's 37, he's grown up, his children don't know what racism is. That is fine. But they need to know what it is. And even though that they haven't been taught racism, they need to know it when they see it. And when but you can make sure that there is redress for anyone whose civil rights have been violated. That is why topics like Proposition 8 are so important. That's why this Islamic Center are so important. This is not about sympathy, because if this was about sympathy, then Glenn Beck would have never went to the Washington Mall this afternoon. And this is the one thing, this is the changing, the moving of the goalposts. It can be correct, but it may not be wise.
Hey, Craig, we've got to go, but one of the things I want to say to you is I appreciate your comments and I appreciate your questions. But, you know, keep in mind the insulation. Keep in mind the inoculation that you have as a non-black person in this country. You know, try to look inside the dragon's mouth for a minute, and also think about redress. that's a key word for you tonight, because redress, when you see there are some laws which redress, there are some laws which protect, but there are some laws that only you and other white people can, there are some things that only you and other white people can do to try to eliminate these barriers and make sure that this is a safe and secure society for your children to grow up in, and that the dream really is a reality for everyone. We thank you for being with us tonight, and say hi to Victor for me. And we got to take a break. When we come back, we're going to be taking 334's call, and we thank all of you for being with us. I'm Janice Graham at Our Common Ground, and my co-host tonight is Alpho of The Alpho Show. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Our Common Ground. This is Saturday Night Open Mic. I'm Janice Graham, and I'll be listening for you. We want to hear from you. Our number, 347-838-9852, to join in on this conversation.
It is with sound mind and body that I, James Fredericks III, after fighting with all direct family members for decades, leave my entire fortune of $32 million to the one friend I had in the end, the package delivery guy, Matt Songer.
Woohoo! Yeah! I had a feeling about this. Uh-huh! I'm rich! Oh, this cannot be happening.
Actually, it's not happening.
What?
And it never will.
I don't get it.
There aren't even people here. That's just one of those murmuring sound effects.
Seriously?
Listen, if you want to have money in your future, don't rely on luck.
Huh.
Put $10 away each month. Cook once in a while instead of eating out.
Okay.
Pay down your high-interest credit card.
Right.
Small changes today, big bucks tomorrow.
So, no inheritance?
No. Go to feedthepig.org for more free ideas.
Feedthepig.org.
This message brought to you by the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants and the Ad Council.
And just to be clear, no inheritance, right?
Hi out there, this is Janice Graham of Our Common Ground. Want to remind you of some of the terrific broadcast shows available to all you talkers. The India Declare Show, Monday through Friday at 11 a.m. and Saturday at 11 a.m. The Alpha Show, every Saturday, 3 p.m. And following that 3 p.m. broadcast, he's at TruthWorks Network at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And don't forget, of all the audio documentary being provided at TruthWorks Network here at Blog Talk Radio, I'm Janice Graham, and I'm sure me and my friends will be listening for you. You know, Alpha, I figured it out. It's what you've been saying all along.
Finally, our premium level, the Congress! For this, you had to live in luxury, write laws that benefit your wealthiest contributors, and steal everything you can find till you're indicted.
You're listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Grant, Alpha of the Alpha Show.
Thank you so much for being with me tonight as my co-host here at Our Common Ground. Open mic Saturday night, and we are tonight, for those of you who are just joining us, we have been talking about the March on Washington, the 47th anniversary of the largest political march ever to hit the United States. The march was organized by a group of civil rights, labor, and religious organizations under the theme of jobs and freedom. There are estimates of the number of participants varied from 200,000, which was reported by the Washington, D.C. police, to over 300,000, which was reported by the leaders of the march. And observers estimated that 75 to 80% of the marchers were black, and the rest were white and other minorities. This march, 47 years ago, was widely credited with helping to pass the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the National Voting Rights Act of 1965. And for those of you who want to know, Alpho, do you want to know, Alpho, why we keep marching? Because every time we march, Million Man March, Million Woman March, March on the Department of Education, something happens. How you doing tonight, Alpho?
Well, I'm doing just great. With today's events, and I won't bring up this rodeo clown, but with today's...
We're not going to talk about rodeo clown. Because we're going to move into... We have one more call that we're going to take on the Washington March. When we move into the second segment of the show, we've got to move pretty quickly. So 334, we're going to go to you. Good evening. You're on Our Common Ground. I respect you, Hotep.
Yeah, hello there, Janice Alpha. Greetings. This is Donna. What a wonderful
political insider.
Yes, I'm telling you. And I think this is wonderful that you guys are doing this tonight. And I love the fact that, you know, you're getting a lot of us white people that are listening and we're calling in. And I just want to say to these guys that are younger than I am, it is easy here. You know, you're living in your little white insulated house, and all your friends are, you know, socially acceptable, and they're not racist. But we don't need to forget that here in the South, racism still lives. It still thrives, and it is still being taught to children every single day. And we do need to take the time to explain to our white children what it was like years ago. Because my daughter, my youngest child, she's almost 17, she did not, thankfully, get to see a lot of it firsthand. But when we moved in the little community we're in now, we became the minority. The majority of the people who live here are black. And she started hearing people referring to us as white people that lived down the road. She said, Mama, why do they call us that? Because we'd never lived in a place that was predominantly black before. So it gave us an opportunity to sit down and for me to explain to her what it was like when I was a kid, when there really was a big difference everywhere between being a white child and being a black child. And I just want to congratulate y'all for pointing this out and doing it in a way that challenges people intellectually but doesn't threaten people and stir up their anger. I appreciate that.
Thank you, Donna, so much. You know, one of the things is that I do want to say to everyone that simply because you are pro-black does not mean you are anti-white.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
It simply means that you understand the experience, you understand your standing. I mean, Donna, I think that coming out of the civil rights movement, the black liberation movement, that I was one of the generation of, I am one of the generation that lived both in Jim Crow and out of Jim Crow.
Mm-hmm.
I am one of the first recipients of this thing called integration. I spent 3 years in an all-white high school as the first black student at Palm Beach High School in Palm Beach County, Florida. Then I went to Wellesley College. Then I went to the Sloan School at MIT. I understand what it is to be black through that experience.
Mm-hmm.
I understand what it is to be black living in a segregated community where I never went to anything other than a black doctor, a black dentist, a black grocery store, a black drugstore, a black cleaners, and a black movie until I was in the 10th grade. I knew what it was like for my mother to have a charge card at a department store, but you couldn't try on the clothing.
Mm-hmm.
I knew what it was like about a lot of things. And just as Craig says it, you know, indicates that he was insulated until I was in the 9th grade, I was insulated as well. Mm. I didn't know black was bad.
Yeah.
I had no idea that black was bad. I had no idea that there was something wrong with being black. And now we have generation after generation of black children who are being told, who see, who listen to the messages every day that there is something wrong with being black. You want to be anything but black. Because if you're a black woman, then you're a hoochified hoe, one step from a prostitute. Mm-hmm. If you're a black man, you know you're taking drugs and you know you're going to steal my stuff.
And it's sad, too, that in this day and age, all these years later, after so many people went through everything that they went through to try to wake up America a little bit, that now once again we see corrupt politicians who are trying to use fear and racism as a political tool. And I'm just asking people, and I've said this for months, if you live here in the South, and even if you don't live here in the South, when you hear someone who stands up and uses racism as a tool to divide, to do the bait and switch so we're not looking at the big issues, you need to get on the phone and you need to call that person and demand an apology as they are handing in their resignations. It's just that simple. When we call people out, then we're doing something. As Alpha says, we're pushing back. We don't want to just talk about it, people. We want to push
That's
back.
Right. That's right.
Thank you so much for taking my call.
Thank you, Donna, and we love you very much.
I love you, too. Thank you so much. Y'all are doing a great job.
Thank you, Donna.
Hey, Alpha, I love you. I love you, too, but, you know, I don't want to say it on the air. We're going to move into our next segment, and thank you so much for all of you who call Craig and Richie and Donna. And for those of you who do not know, Donna is Empowered Women and Political Insight here at Blog Talk Radio. It's the first time she's called into our common ground. It must be you, Alpha.
I talk.
In our chat room. What?
I speak on Donna's programs quite a bit because, I interact with everyone. I mean,
yes.
And when I say I interact,
you're a man about Blog Talk Radio, Alpha. You're on TruthWorks at 4 o'clock on Saturday. And for those of you who don't know, we'll talk a little bit about TruthWorks. But we need to keep it moving here. But we do want to thank Dr. Don and Craig and Empowered Women, Donna, who just called, Irish Green Eyes, the Voxor. Don't forget her show tomorrow here at Blog Talk Radio at 6 p.m. And Victor, thank you all for being with us. And for those of you who are not in the chat room, you can join the chatters, the Our Common Ground Saturday Night Chatters with Ms. India DeClaire right in the chat room at blogtalkradio.com/OCG. I'm Janice Graham, and he's Alpha, and we're going to move into, many of you may not know, may not remember, all you young people, that does not include you, Alpha, that on August 28th, 1955, Emmett Till, an African-American boy from Chicago, Illinois, was murdered at the age of 14 in Money, Mississippi, a small town in the state's Delta region, after reportedly whistling at a white woman, her name was Carolyn Bryant, at a small grocery store, the corner store in Money, where Emmett and his cousins had bought some candy. Bryant was the wife of the store owner, Roy Bryant. The murder of Emmett Till 50 years ago today was noted as one of the leading events that motivated the American Civil Rights. I prepared an audio that I think Alpha will help our audience put all of it in perspective, a little bit about the Emmett Till story. You're listening to Our Common Ground, and this is a brief summary of the story of Emmett Till and his murder and the subsequent stories that were told from Money, Mississippi, all the way through Chicago. Now, when Emmett Till was murdered, I was only 5 years old. But when I heard of this story, I was 5 years old, and it was the murder of Emmett Till that made a little girl in West Palm Beach, Florida, understand that children died. I never thought of a child being dead until I read in the newspaper, heard on the news, and heard the adults in my community talking about it. This is a story, a very brief summary of the story of Emmett Till.
In a little tent, oh, and just like the river, I've been running ever since. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will.
And I shrugged them. I said, turn me loose. I've got a job to do. And I don't have time to be fainting now. I saw his tongue had been choked out and it was lying down on his chin. I saw that this eye was out and it was lying about midway the cheek. I looked at this eye, and it was gone. I looked at the bridge of his nose, and it looked like someone had taken a meat chopper and chopped it.
Swing low, sweet chariot, coming forth to carry me. Won't you let me ride, oh,
swing down, chariot, stop and let me ride, oh, rock me, Lord, rock me, Lord, oh, come and easy,
I got a horse,
on the side,
oh, six white horses standing side by side, oh, swing,
six white horses standing side by side, oh, rock me, Lord, rock me, Lord, come and easy,
I got a horse,
on the side,
to the Southern establishment that lorded over its black citizens. Till's death at first had no impact.
They considered his death as basically nothing. And you have to consider that in Mississippi and in the South in these days, the deaths of black Americans did not merit news.
The possibility of a trial or a conviction was also a non-issue.
I am the uncle of Emmett Lewis Till. Sunday morning, about 2:30, someone called at the door. And I said, who is it? And he said, this is Mr. Bride. I want to talk with you and the boy. And when I opened the door, there was a man standing with a pistol in one hand and a flashlight in the other hand. And he asked me, did I have two boys there from Chicago? I told him I have. And he said, I wanted I want the boy that done all that talk and then march him to the car and they asked someone there, was this is the right boy? And the answer was, yes. And they drove toward money.
And I found out about it 9:30 Sunday morning. I was in bed. I got up, called my mother when I got the news, because I had every decision I had ever made or every crack that I had ever been in, it took her to get me out of it. And I took that one to Mama too, because I didn't know what to do. Mother told me to come right over, and she would start making calls. And I got over there as quickly as I could make it. And that wasn't very long.
Time of immature death, I was 13 years old. And me and my friends were walking down the streets, and we walked up and to the truck that Too Tight and Jimmy Lee was washing out. And I asked him, what was the blood from? And he told me that it was from a deer they killed that night. But later on, I found out that it was not a deer. It was Emmett Till's blood.
J.W. Marlin told my father they went and picked Emmett Till up, and they was going to kind of like rough him up or beat him up a little bit and let him go. That was his story. But Roy and Kimball really, really beat him bad, and things just really got out of hand. That was his story, but we know better. And beat him up so bad till he asked Leroy Too Tight Colin and gave him the gun and told him to shoot him and get him out of his misery.
My name is Henry Law, and I was supposed to have been involved with Emmett Till murder, but I wasn't. And I still can't figure out why they would have me involved in that. And I know nothing about it, no more what was told. This woman named Mary, she came up. She says, y'all heard about what happened last night? The law? And they said, yeah. I said, you know, J.W. and them went over to Money's and killed a boy and put him in the river. It wasn't a river, Black Bow. So, I said, no, we ain't heard nothing about that. And so she said, said Too Tight said, that shoe laying on. I said, that's a shoe that boy had on. So they went to this boy's grandparents and asked about him. His granddad said, he's in there asleep. I said, what you want with him? I said, well, wake him up. We're going to get him out of there.
The history of Mississippi, and I'd say in general in the South, was that no whites had ever been convicted for killing blacks.
It is in that setting that he was killed with a degree of permissiveness. That is how grotesque, how sick the country was at that time.
Within days of his death, Emmett Till's body was found at the bottom of the Tallahatchie River. It was wired to the 75-pound fan to keep it from floating up. When his remains were sent back to Chicago, his mother was torn apart with grief. But the wooden box that held his body had been nailed shut. There were instructions from the Mississippi coroner that under no circumstances was it to be unsealed. But this was Chicago, and Emmett's mother demanded to see her son one last time. After seeing what was left of her son, Mamie insisted on an open casket funeral.
I wanted the world to look in and see. And so that's when I decided to let the world come in and see, because it was something that I could not handle alone.
There were many people lynched and assassinated, but something about the Emmett Till killing, maybe that something was the way people were able to see it all around the nation.
America could no longer pretend that lynchings, the vigilante murders of blacks, were an acceptable or inevitable fact of life. In the post-Civil War era, there had been thousands of lynchings. Emmett Till's death underscored two points: that things had to change, but also that there'd be blood spilled on the way.
That picture of Emmett shows us the ugliness of racism. And because the world was able to see Emmett in that state, that brought on the what we call the modern civil rights movement.
The Southern newspaper said all the right things, that Till's murder was brutal and senseless, and that the people of Mississippi deplored this brutal act. And yet, when Roy Bryant and J.W. Milam were arrested and ordered to stand trial, some of those white Southerners who were shocked would find a way to take care of their own. In 1955, J.W. Milam and Roy Bryant were charged with the brutal slaying of Emmett Till in Money, Mississippi. As America pointed an accusing finger at the South, white Mississippians who'd previously decried the killing now circled their wagons. They raised $10,000 for the accused's legal expenses, and five local lawyers volunteered to defend them. During their testimony, Milam and Bryant brazenly admitted to kidnapping and beating the boy. And yet, the all-white jury deliberated for just 1 hour and acquitted them of murder. In 1955, this was the way justice was meted out in the South.
The white power structure of the South, in effect, endorsed their activities by not prosecuting them when they committed crimes, or if whites sat on juries, they simply nullify the evidence, just end up with find them not guilty. So they felt they had a license to kill.
Sometime after the acquittal, Milam sold his story to Look magazine. He admitted to an interviewer that he and Bryant had in fact shot Till in the head. But Emmett Till's death would not go down as just another lynching.
People didn't forget it. It had just a galvanizing effect, particularly on the black population.
Dr. King would often say, honor and suffering is redemptive, and there's power in innocent blood. The innocent blood of Emmett Till exploded and hit the national consciousness in ways that was irreversible.
And that was 50 years ago that on today that Emmett Till was murdered in Money, Mississippi. Alpha, you know, you just typed in our chat room that Emmett Till was a 14-year-old child. And India Declare is saying in the chat room that this is so totally egregious, pure evil. And Irish Green is commenting, it is Irish Green Eyes. It is so sad that people are like this. And Empowered Women, Donna, who was our last caller, is saying that that same evil is now producing racism once again. All you have to do is watch the news. She also commented that she doesn't go through Mississippi. It feels bad, low vibes. And I just want to point out that in my activities with gray-haired witnesses, I am a witness. I am a witness to a panicked community when Medgar Evers was murdered in Mississippi. I am a witness to Jamie and Gladys Scott, who remain in prison after 16 years, two life sentences each, for a crime that involved $11. No one got hurt. No one got killed. No one went to the hospital. That is a brand of Mississippi justice that we still stand in this country with a man who has the audacity to talk about he wants to be the president of the United States and at the same time criticize the current one, a man who is fair, intelligent, and with good heart and goodwill. Alpha, explain it to me, please. Somebody call up here because our number is 347-838-9852.
Janice.
That when a 14-year-old boy, and when I was 5 or 6, when I heard about this Emmett Till murder and saw Huntley Brinkley carried scenes from the his funeral on NBC News.
Janice,
I spent days trying to figure out after seeing how his face, what kind of people do this?
Well, this is, and, you know, you can call it exactly what it is, pure evil. And this is what today's racists are trying to run from. This is why they act like kids throwing rocks and hiding their hands. This is why someone like a Glenn Beck or a Laura, whatever her name is, Laura Schlesinger. This is why you have this hatred from a Rush Limbaugh. This is why they try to run away from that label of being a racist, because this is the evil behind racism. This is the pure evil. And if this was just one of thousands of murders and lynchings, throughout
but
the
you
South.
See, if people knew this history, if people understood the particulars of this kind of history, there was a case in Palm Beach County when I was a young girl involving a judge where the judge and his wife were kidnapped from their home because they had let off a black defendant. They were kidnapped from their Palm Beach home, never to be seen again. And I can't think of their names, but for years and years, I lived with the image of people who oppose the legal system when it worked for black people. Because my father kept saying that when they were talking, when the adults in my community were talking about it, when they were talking about it at the NAACP meetings, you know, because, you know, back then, parents, if my mother had a board meeting at the Y or NAACP meeting, or I had to go. We didn't have babysitters because all the kids old enough to babysit were busy doing something at the school. So these are the images. So we bristle when we hear about an Oscar Grant or the fact that a 7-year-old sleeping on her sofa in her living room in the middle of the night is murdered by the Detroit police, or when a prominent attorney in Miami Beach, in Miami, Florida, is gunned down by police while riding his motorcycle back in 1969. We bristle when we hear the rhetoric of Rush Limbaugh and Glenn Beck, because we know these stories. They weren't stories. You know, it's interesting that most white people never read about these stories in their newspapers, because in the mainstream newspapers, they weren't reported. You had to read the Pittsburgh Courier or the Chicago Defender. You had to read the Amsterdam News or the other newspapers out of major black outlets. You had to read local black press to read about these stories. And I'm not sure, and it was said that if the Emmett Till had not lived in Chicago and the Chicago papers carried it, no one in this country would have known about the murder of Emmett Till.
You're absolutely right. That is an absolute fact. And as you heard in that segment, because he was brought back to Chicago, and it was Chicago, and African Americans back then were defiant.
Exactly.
They were defiant.
And I'm going to tell you that in the history of this story, the state attorney and the state prosecutor got the governor to sign a proclamation which said that his casket could never be opened. But when his mother got his body back to Chicago, she didn't care about Southern and Mississippi justice. She opened the casket, and this child was absolutely mutilated. If you go to the show page, if you go to my Facebook page, if you go to the link of the EmmettTillMurder.com that I posted in our chat room, you will see him in his casket, and his face is absolutely obliterated. And even in the audio pieces that I put together, his mother talks about missing one eye. She also talks about where they shot him. You could look in the hole and see light on the other side.
Well, Janice, that's why the viciousness, the monsters that did this, and this is why you will find that this photos of this child in this casket, it resurrects a lot of and shakes the emotions of a lot of people, and it's so powerful, and this is why you'll have people from the other side who will say, oh, there you go again with, you know, the race card. And that is the same effect and the same reason why they want to downplay racism. And they want to downplay just the act itself because they don't understand it and it never happened to them.
While this was 50 years ago, we have very contemporary history that tells the same story.
You're right.
It tells us the exact same story. So, and then what we do is we allow people to put spins on it. For instance, how many police officers have been exonerated? Look at Sean Bell in Brooklyn, New York. 57 gunshots, and nobody went to jail. That was 5 years ago. Look at the young African brother who was pulling out his wallet, thinking the police were trying to arrest him, thinking he was illegal. So he's pulling out his green card, and they shoot him 69 times. Look at the Haitian brother who was so brutally molested with a toilet plunger in the precinct by police and how it was covered up.
Look at the Danziger Bridge shooting. That was just a few years ago.
That was
and
5
you
years
have,
ago today.
And this is what's so hurtful to African Americans. You actually have people who are simply dismissive of facts. The Oscar Grant shooting and the results of this manslaughter 2 conviction that gives this police officer what, 2 years in prison? If he does a year at the max, that was pure murder. That was a homicide because number one, a taser gun and a real gun are different in weight. He could not have possibly thought that he was pulling out his taser. And if he were, why was he tasing this man on the ground with his hands cuffed behind him? Why was he tasing him then? So nothing fits. When you get the brutal beating of a Rodney King and you get a jury, and where was the place in California, Simi Valley? When they can still nullify the facts, nullify a video, then that's what gets under the skin of African Americans. Because we know that racism is prevalent, it's alive and well. This is notwithstanding the disparaging hiring, the disparaging, I mean, the redlining, the whole entire scenario. We pay more for insurance. We get our schools funded less. And then you have someone who has the audacity to ask, what about the temperature of the African-American community today? And they simply don't understand. And that's my problem with people who of that ilk. If you don't understand, then you need to educate yourself before you come into a room with rhetorical rhetoric and specious questions. You know, you can ask a question, but damn.
The thing is that if you say you want racial harmony in this country, you have to work for it. You have to understand what you are asking. And if you're not willing to work for it, then you don't want it. If you don't understand, you know, one of the things that I always say, that I've been black for 60 years, and that has given me an education that someone who is not black for 60 years does not have. That is why I am a gray-haired witness, because I saw the crossover, and I saw it before it came, and I saw it after it came. And that's what makes me a witness to all of this. The other thing that we have to do is we have to speak truth to power. We have to not back up, because we know, I mean, when you look at the gathering on the Washington Mall today at the Lincoln Memorial, we know what that is all about. When I say, having been a talk show host since 1983, having studied day after day the workings of the political machine, seeing it in my professional work, seeing it in my life, I know that all of this is about the fear of a black president, every bit of it. No one can convince me otherwise. Hey, Alpha, you know what we need to do? We need to take a break, and then when we come back, I'm not so sure we're going to get to. I do want to go to looking at Katrina. We may go to it for a little bit, and we've only got about 25 minutes left in the show, and that's going to take us right up to the top. What do you think we ought to do?
Well,
5 years ago today.
Well, I think I think we would be better off simply touching on Katrina and not listening to the speech.
Let's take a stab at it.
I would like to say about Katrina.
Okay, let's take a stab at it.
Hey, you are a savior.
We're broke. We're suffering. We have nothing. Being the mayor of this city is like being on the field of battle.
I don't know who he cursed, but this is unbelievable.
This oil spilling is the biggest environmental disaster in American history.
But we didn't give up. We didn't lose faith, but people need to see what we're going through.
What we're seeing on TV, that's the type of stuff you see in third world countries. This is America. It shouldn't be happening here.
Treat us like we was un-American, like we lost our citizenship.
They cannot say that they did not have the means. Our government is supposed to be one of the greatest. But it's proven to me that, hey, if you don't have money, you don't have status, you don't have a government.
A lot of people don't realize it takes many years for a city to get back on its feet. I know for sure the people down there appreciate putting the mics in their hands and the cameras in their face and let them tell their stories. In less than 5 years, Hurricane Katrina, the great American city of New Orleans, 80% underwater, and now the biggest environmental disaster in the history of the United States of America.
It's the same old thing. The city of New Orleans is still undone, incomplete, and now we have British Petroleum who has messed up the ecology.
And we're not getting any pleasure filming this. It was our job as filmmakers to document it.
This is my daughter, Serena, who drowned in Hurricane Katrina. She was 5 years old, and I never got a chance to say goodbye.
Despite the tragedy that came upon the people of New Orleans, one of the things I think we've documented is the resilient spirit of the people.
I'm in school for nursing. I want to have a career and pursue all of my dreams and be able to raise my two sons, Armando and Jamal. And I want my sons to be able to pursue a dream and make something positive of themselves.
At the same time, we're still able to get a lot of humor in that. It's that old saying, I have to laugh to keep from crying. I think that we got a lot of that too.
I was single at the time, and I said, I need to hook up with a lady.
He was dirty, he was filthy, he had a stench. I don't know if it was him personally, but I know everybody stunk, so I knew he did.
The way we do the interviews is like a dialogue, this back and forth.
I guess it was fate, but the first thing I wanted to do, I wanted to see her feet. So I came from behind
the... Hold up. See her feet?
Yeah, she had on some open-toe shoe. I have a foot fetish.
It helps them put down the facade and just be who they are. They were rebounding from Hurricane Katrina. Then they go to the heights, the zenith, with the Super Bowl win. The Super Bowl was an amazing thing for the people, not just New Orleans, but the people of the Gulf States.
4.5 years ago, we lost our home during the flood, and we are so privileged and honored to be here.
When you've been kicked, beat up, dragged down, your morale, your spirit is very low.
After Super Bowl on that Sunday, I was going to have to get up and figure out how I was going to eat the next day, how I was going to pay my bills, how I was going to be able to survive. I'm not a who dat. I'm a who is that.
2936.
There's a thing called Katrina fatigue. People forget. People are dealing with this whole thing by drinking and using drugs. The mental health of people is horrible. The suicide rate is twice the level it was pre-Katrina. At the same time, the only public hospital to treat mental health, Cherry Hospital, is closed. So people are on edge. People are on edge.
All of this area here, we have 1,500 families living here. Mostly poor black women and children.
A lot of this public housing was intact after Hurricane Katrina, but the powers that be pulled the gangster Corleone move and used that as an opportunity and knocked down public housing.
It's 100,000 poor people displaced out of this city. And you cowards are going to wipe out people are scattered across America and trying to tear down the public housing.
Right.
How cowardly are you?
So, yeah, people dispersed all over the United States of America. We have no place to come back to.
Dear Army Corps of Engineers, I just want to let you know you effed my life up.
The biggest misconception is that it was Hurricane Katrina that did the damage. It was the faulty, shoddy work of the United States Army Corps Engineers that did the damage.
There's nothing positive about living in a FEMA trailer. That, not for me. I was used to my space. My one-bedroom apartment that I had before Katrina hit was good for me. My energy was good. My thinking was good. I was moving. I was growing. But it stifles your thinking. I was dying.
Phyllis was the first person we interviewed. Interview went very well. And then as we made our subsequent trips, we kept shooting more of Phyllis.
We shall.
And then became apparent she might be the voice of this whole thing.
No more use of our Gulf Coast waters, wetlands, heritage, and soil. No more up yours, Louisiana. But we all know there's blood in that BPR. If God is willing and a creek don't rise.
As far as their title goes, my grandmother, Zimmy Shelton, she lived to be 100 years old. And she put me through Morehouse, put me through NYU Film School. When I would speak to her, I would say, I'll call you tomorrow. And she would say, if God is willing and the creek don't rise, I'll be here to answer the phone. You might not be here tomorrow if it's not God's will.
Here for a couple of days to see what surviving Katrina still looks like here in this great place, here in New Orleans. The original name for where I'm standing right now was the Calliope Housing Projects. Looks like Calliope, but if you're in New Orleans, sounds like Calliope. And it then became the B.W. Cooper Public Housing Projects, and that's where I'm standing right now. It should be noted that it's really not the B.W. Cooper Housing Projects anymore. It's not anything anymore. B.W. Cooper, along with three other huge housing projects in New Orleans, a couple of years ago got torn down, leveled. Not necessarily because they were storm damaged. A lot of them really weren't. A lot of them were very solid construction and didn't have much damage at all. But the city voted in 2007, city council voted in 2007 to tear them down. And in 2008, down they came. The New Orleans City Council voted to demolish the public housing in 07. In 08, the demolition happened. More than 3,000 apartments, many of them totally undamaged by the storm and the flooding. Many of them occupied. They were torn down. Now, it's not like the projects were Shangri-La. They were dangerous. And I talked with folks today who had lived in the project before the storm and who thought that the best thing to do was to tear them down. But it was housing. It was housing for poor people who couldn't otherwise afford to live in this city. The idea was to use the storm as a pretext to not just tear down those big bad housing projects, but to replace them with mixed-use housing. So woefully poor people wouldn't be concentrated in big giant blocks. Some of that replacement building is complete. Some, well, see for yourself. That's B.W. Cooper. Here's a site where the rebuilding is well underway. This is or used to be the St. Bernard Public Housing Project. And from where I'm standing right here, you can actually get a pretty good shot of the before and the after, even though some of the before is still now. This is what the housing units here essentially used to look like. This is some of the original structure. Across the street here, actually, if you just pan over here with me, you can see this is some of the new development. You can see how different it is. This is intended to be mixed-income housing. It's not intended to be all subsidized, income-dependent public housing. So they tore down 963 public housing units here. The new development, at least so far, is about 465, so significantly fewer. But in terms of what's still available here, in terms of really public, heavily subsidized housing like this all used to be here, it's only about 150 units.
And you know, Alpha, I have to ask, who that? You know, one of the things that is clear, and for those of you who are listening, that was some clips from a week of shows that I did last year with leading activists in New Orleans, and some of it was the majority of it Spike Lee talking about his HBO documentary that premiered this week on HBO, God Willing, If the Creek Don't Rise. And then there was Rachel Maddow, who was on a location in New Orleans this week to commemorate and to recognize the five-year anniversary of the Katrina hurricane. But, Alpha, as you know, we know that the hurricane was not the problem. And even now, the people of New Orleans and the people of other smaller communities across the Louisiana Gulf Coast suffer from this government's inability, unwillingness to restore this community. What kind of government is it that doesn't recognize that it has to play a major role in this, on top of the absolute lies that have been told about what is happening in regard to public housing and housing being available for? And for those of you who have not seen, you can go on YouTube and see some of the footage if you don't have HBO, but if you do have HBO, make sure you see the two-part documentary, "The God Willing, the Creek Don't Rise," because it brings you up to the point of the crisis after the BP oil spill. I know you had a lot to say about this, Alpha. When I hear this, I go a little bit crazy. 157 units replaced of housing assistance to the 987 units that of them 500 and some were usable and could have been rehabilitated rather than demolished. What say you, Alpha?
Let me put it like this. This is today's racism. This is pure evil. And when I speak about today's racism, when people are dismissive of how this has played out, be it genocide of the hurricane itself or gentrification, which is the aftermath of the hurricane. It's pure evil. This government that was run by a black HUD administrator, and as he was dictated to by a George W. Bush.
And, of course, you're talking about the crook, Alphonso Jackson, who was under indictment and has not gone to trial as yet.
Well, that's what I mean. These people continue to commit crimes from this administration, and they continue to get a free pass. And this is the racism, and this is what boils under the skin of African Americans. When you see this type of gentrification, as the city council voted to demolish public housing and housing, subsidized housing. This is what they were trying to do. The lower Ninth Ward, they had no intentions of restoring it. They had no intentions of making enough money available to rehab these houses. And in this piece that Rachel Maddow did, she was in a middle-class neighborhood for African-Americans that is a stone's throw from this, what is it, Pachacani, or however you pronounce it, this lake.
Pachacondra. Uh-huh.
It's
really interesting that, you know, five years later, we're seeing Michael Brown, who was the FEMA director, the assistant secretary of FEMA. He's being resurrected. His professional image and his professional reputation is being resurrected and repaired. We have not heard from Alfonso Jackson, who was not responsive to the housing needs of the citizens of displaced citizens of Louisiana, of New Orleans, and who left HUD after he was being indicted for setting up businesses and business and contracts for his friends, both in New Orleans and elsewhere, Texas and Atlanta. We have not, you know, when I did the week of shows, and I'm so proud that after doing that 5 days of shows revisiting Louisiana, and for those of you who are with us tonight, if you'd like to hear the archives of that week of shows and revisiting New Orleans and the crisis brought on by the flood and the hurricane, you can go to ustalknetwork.com and listen to those archive shows. But of those five shows, every one of my the Our Common Ground guests were featured in either the Rachel Maddow show this week in revisiting New Orleans, or appear in the Spike Lee documentary. Tracy Washington of the Louisiana Justice Institute, Mike Morial of the Louisiana Justice Institute. We had some clip, but we cut it short, of other people. James Perry, who was at the time a candidate for the mayor of New Orleans, Kali Akuno, and it was just really heartwarming to hear that you at Our Common Ground heard what they had to say long before Spike Lee started his documentary and long before we are now going back and reexamining. And many people were kind of confused about why I was revisiting New Orleans. It is the public presence and image of what happens to disenfranchised and black and brown people in this country when there is a disaster.
And the those deniers, Janice, deniers continue not to understand.
It really does tell you about the lies that our government is willing to tell.
Exactly. Those deniers that continue to pretend that somehow we've come a long way, but they can't see the racial discrimination that has been involved. The levees still aren't repaired. If you had another Category 4 come through there tomorrow, the same thing would repeat. It would be history repeating itself. No one would go to jail. No one would be held accountable, just like the Bush era.
They are doing the same thing with the BP oil spill.
Exactly.
All these people running around eating oysters and mussels and shrimp and crabs, more power to you. I won't be eating any at all for a long, long time because I'm not trusting who's telling me where it's coming from. Alpha, I've really enjoyed this this evening with you and with Empowered Women and Ms. India DeClaire and Doc Don and Victor and Richie and
Craig.
What was the, what?
Craig.
Yes, Craig. And we have guest 4102 and the Vaxar in our chat room and all of you who have been out there listening. We were going to talk about the Reclaim the Dream rally, but we're running out of time, and I think that we need to take some time. We do have clips of the interview that Joe Madison did with Glenn Beck, and I think what we need to do is try to get to that next Saturday night. We're not going away, but it's really, really important for us to sit back and think that the March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, Alpha, 47 years ago, we're still talking about the same issues. No matter what, as an African-American and black citizen of this nation, the I Have a Dream speech is as relevant as it was to me as it was when I was 13, as it is today relevant to me in my life and my family's life. And it is relevant in terms of looking at what we saw on the Washington Mall today, what we hear from the Becks and the Limbaughs and the Sarah Palins and the distorted and confused black people who want to cavort. Is cavort a good word, Alpha? Cavort with them. So we'll revisit that next week. And we want to thank all of you for being with us and to let you know that we are part of TruthWorks Network. And we encourage you to go to TruthWorks Network, where we host a great deal of very important audio documentaries. One of the documentaries that we will be hosting this week on TruthWorks on Tuesday night at 8 p.m. will be 500 Years Later, which is the history of Africans coming to this country. And looking at what that has meant, we in our archives, you can also find the history of racism. Next week on Friday night, we will be hosting at 8 a.m. a rebroadcast of a show which I think is very important. It is a discussion about black liberation theology between Dr. Reverend Michael Eric Dyson and Dr. Reverend Jeremiah Wright. Thank you all for so much for being with us tonight here at Our Common Ground. We invite you to be with us each Saturday night for Saturday Night Open Mic, Our Common Ground. And that's going to take us right into our close. Thank you. Alpha, thanks again. Thanks, everybody in the chat room. I'm Janice Graham. This is Speaking Truth to Power and Ourselves at Our Common Ground. I'll be listening for you.
You've been listening to Our Common Ground at Blog Talk Radio. I'm Janice Graham. Thank you for being with us. These are our stories. This is our mission. This is our challenge. We thank you for your calls and your input. We hope you'll join us each Saturday night here at Our Common Ground. Our Common Ground, speaking truth to power and ourselves. This is Alternative Activist Empowerment Talk Radio.
Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long, a long